Blog Talk Radio.
Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, retired chief of police and private investigator, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send a Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, then please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
This evening on Crime Wire, we're going to take listeners behind the events of the crime and the public scrutiny. On January 24, 2011, Amy Sue Hansley, age 30 and mother of Jared and James, vanished from her home in Hartford, Michigan. Within hours, the public also discovered that another woman, Tanya Howrath, a family acquaintance, was also missing. A national alert went out over the media airwaves. The search and recovery organization, the Missing You Foundation, a nonprofit agency assisting missing persons in Michigan, jumped into action and began a full-scale search effort. There was a lot of publicized, mostly negative speculation, minus the facts, before, during, and after regarding the women's murders from the media. In my opinion, it was inexcusable for the media and social networking sites to attack a homicide survivor and his family. 4 days later, with the assistance of searcher Jamie Jones with the Missing You Foundation, Amy Hensley and Tanya Howrath were found in a shallow grave on the property of a cousin of Amy's husband, Junior Lee Beebe. He was arrested and charged with both murders. The case received national attention and much speculation. Tonight, joining us on Crime Wire are widower James Hensley and the man who discovered the women, Jamie Jones. Gentlemen, welcome to Crime Wire.
Hello, Denny.
Hi, Denny. Thanks for having us.
Glad you're able to join us tonight. I'd like, if we could start with you, James, would you talk a little bit with us and tell the listeners about Amy, how you met her, when you were married, that type of thing?
Well, I met her, it was 12 years ago, just last Friday. I met her through some friends with in town one day, and I asked her if she had a boyfriend, and she said no, and I asked her if she wanted one, and then
you asked her if she wanted one?
Yeah, I asked her if she wanted one.
That's so sweet.
And she just smiled at me, and then she had another friend get a hold of me the next day and ask if she could call me, and that's when we started talking. And then
and
I
how
ended
long
up... Well, we were together 6 months before we got married.
Okay, and now, then you had the two children.
Yep, she's actually pregnant with Jonah when we were together for about 2 months later with Jared.
Okay.
And then Jonah came along 3 years later.
Okay, now, if you would, tell us about the morning of January 24th. Did it begin like just a normal day? Was any? Do you have any clue at all?
Talk about what Amy did in the morning, you know, to get you guys all out of the house.
Well, we had a routine where she'd get the boys up. She always got up a lot earlier than us. And she's getting the boys off to the bus, and she'll wake me up before they leave. And and say the goodbyes while I go to work and get them on the bus to school. It's just an everyday thing we did.
And then so that morning on the 24th, that was a normal morning. You had one car there, and so you she didn't need the car that day, so she stayed home. There was no place she needed to be. Otherwise, you would have had her drive you to work, wouldn't you have?
Right. Yeah. Of course. Well, we actually have two vehicles, but earlier that week, my water pump went out in my car, so I needed to use the truck until I fixed my car.
And so she was home, normal, no big deal. And every day at a certain time, and I love this about you, and I wish more husbands, if you're listening, you would do this. Every day at a certain time, you'd call your wife from work, wouldn't you?
Oh, every day. On my 10 o'clock break,
so what,
and then...
10 o'clock break. And what would you guys discuss? Nancy Grace and what was going on in the news, right?
Oh, yeah, everything on the news. If she... She even called me before that if she'd seen something crazy on TV and just let me know about it.
Wasn't she in between going back to school? She had just left her employment some months before, and she kind of took the time off, and she'd been working for her parents' business. And then, she was going to be going back to school to become a nurse?
Yes. Actually, she's been going on and off to school, with the kids and everything. It makes it hard. And she went and signed up and was going to attend again this fall.
Talk about your relationship with her mom and her family, how close you guys all were.
Oh, we have a great relationship, and still to this day we're super close. Actually, her mom's pretty much became the mother to my kids now. She does everything for us and always has, and she's a great lady, and so is Bob, which is Amy's dad. They're great people.
And I think that was important for you in the days and the months ahead, but it was important around this time, wasn't it?
Yes, for sure.
I mean, it meant everything. And so that day, it when you call home, do you call home at 10 o'clock?
Yep. I called home, and I didn't get an answer that day.
So what did you do then?
Well, I figured maybe she was downstairs doing laundry or something, so... Usually if I call and she don't answer, she'll call me right back. And so I wasn't too worried at the moment. And then my break was about up, so I tried calling again, and still no answer. And so I thought maybe she was busy for the moment. And after time went on, a few more minutes, I tried again, and still no answer. Then about 40 minutes later, then I got worried and decided I better leave work and what's going on.
And Denny, most men don't do that, do they? I know you've been married a lot of years.
No, I think you're right. I know I got to plead guilty. Keeping that kind of contact, calling home a couple of times a day and so forth. No, I think that's probably the exception rather than the rule.
And so then when you realize that she's not there, James, and not answering, you get to the house, right? You pull up to the house. Do you see anything unusual? Is the door open? Is the door locked?
Well, the front door was locked, but it was the bottom handle, which it was broken, so we didn't have a key for that one. So that was unusual there. So I went around the back, and our slider door was open, and the dog was still outside. And then I went into the house that way.
What was in the house? Were her purse there? Were her keys there? Were any items that, would make you think that she was coming right back?
Yeah, everything was there except for her coat and her shoes. Her purse was still right on the table where she'd left it.
And so what are you thinking right at that moment? What do you think is where she's at? Is she maybe at a neighbor's? Is she down having coffee down the block?
I thought maybe a friend could have come by and she maybe went and had breakfast or something, but... It was out of the ordinary because any time she would usually call me and let me know.
And that's important. So right then she would call you and tell you, hey, I'm going out with somebody. I'll be back soon and love you and talk to you later, right?
Right, of course.
Okay. And she didn't do that, so then panic mode spent, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And you knew something was really wrong.
Yep.
And who's your first phone call to?
Well, first what it is, I looked around the house to make sure that she didn't fall down our stairs or anything, and yelled for her a few times, and then I went to the phone to maybe see if somebody called, and when I pulled up the caller ID, it was her mom's phone that was the last number called, so I called her mother, and she said that she didn't talk to her since the night before.
Okay, and then what'd you do?
And then I decided I'd just sit and wait for a few minutes and see if I get a phone call or anything. And after that happened, I didn't get anything, so I went driving around thinking maybe she just run uptown with someone or something and come home and still nothing.
At this point, do you call anybody to say, hey, have you seen
anything? Yeah, I'm calling all my friends at this time, calling everybody I know in my contacts list that
okay,
we
is
talked
Junior,
to.
Is Junior Beebe one of them?
No.
Okay.
No, not at this time.
Not at that time. So when do you make the call to the police?
Well, the call to the police?
Yeah.
The call to the police didn't come till later, till my kids got home.
Okay, so earlier that day, you don't go back to work. You're driving around. As time passes with every minute, you're frantically thinking, what happened? Where is she?
Right. And what I did is I came back home, and I thought, well, I'll go to the neighbor's house. Maybe she's seen somebody come over. And that's when I went and talked to her, and she told me about seeing the black truck in the driveway. And
so stop. A neighbor says that there's a black truck. Does she say that your wife gets in the black truck?
She says she's seen someone that resembles my wife, but she wasn't 100% sure.
So what are you thinking right then and there?
I'm thinking, well, maybe she went and helped my cousin or something, which I don't know what it was, because I didn't know if Tanya was with him or not, or the whole situation.
And your cousin is Junior Beebe.
Right.
And so when do you call him and ask him if he's seen Amy?
Well, first I tried calling once the neighbor said she seen that truck, and I realized what truck she was talking about. And so I tried calling him. I didn't get no answer right away, and then he called me back. And that's when I asked him if he's heard from Amy, and he tells me no. Why? And so, because the neighbor said she seen you here this morning and thought she seen Amy get in your truck. And he's like, oh, no, Tanya was with me, and we stopped over, but nobody was home.
What does he tell you? What does he make you believe he is doing that makes you think that, you know, she's not there?
Well, okay, well, after that conversation, we hung up or whatever, and I started just keep calling people or whatnot, and her parents come over. And then he calls me back about, I don't know, it's like an hour and a half, 2 hours later, to asking if I've heard from Amy yet. And I tell him no, and he tells me, well, I haven't heard from Tanya. He said he couldn't get a hold of Tanya. And at this time, he's telling me he's helping my uncle move and make sure
but
I can hear my uncle talk.
In the background, he makes a noise. There's noise enough for you to believe that he's moving his uncle, isn't there?
Yeah. He says, hold on, Uncle Buddy. I'm talking to James. And make sure I can hear my uncle talking to him and everything while they're moving stuff or stop
Denny,
somewhere.
Denny, have you ever... This is a very clever individual. He sets up his alibi. So he disarms James. And he's making it look like he's somewhere when he's already done something, and then calls. How often does a criminal do that?
Well, you know, I'm wondering, based on the sequence that James is telling us, if he had that planned at that point, or if when James called him and said, oh, the neighbor said she saw your truck in my driveway and looked like Amy was getting in it, I wonder if that's when he came up with that and panicked a little bit and said, and then he called James back an hour and a half or something later, after he had a chance to think it up. So I'm not sure whether he, you know, had it already in his head or whether the thought that he may have been spotted by a neighbor it really got him going, thinking he better come up with an alibi. But it was pretty slick in going through the you know, the noise in the background and so forth to make it to aid realism to what he was doing there.
Yeah,
and I think it goes towards what he does, like, to just throw James off, because James isn't going to drive out there and think, because he's moving the uncle, and, you know, Amy Sue's not there. So what do you do after that when you feel like you've exhausted your resources, and pretty soon it's time for the boys to be off the bus from school?
Right, and see, at this point, her mom and dad and everybody's over here with me, and they say, well, when the boys get home, that's when we'll start to worry about it. And because, you know, I would have called the police before that, but you never know. And once the boys got home, they come up the driveway asking where Mom was, and that's when I grabbed the phone and called 911.
And what did they tell you in 911?
They just pretty much tell me that I can do more research or more investigating than they can at the time to keep calling friends and stuff, in which I explained to them, you know, I've tried to call everyone I could think of, and they said...
Did they give you a reason? I'm just wondering, did they tell you why they felt the investigation at that point was better off in your hands than theirs? Was it a manpower issue, or... I'm gathering they weren't overly excited about getting involved in the search. Am I wrong on that? Or
right, I don't think they thought it was anything that was a big deal at the moment or anything that they could really do. They said usually it's like a 24 to 48 hour waiting period for missing people.
Mm-hmm. You know, would you, before we go too much further, explain a little bit about Tanya, just exactly who she was and where she fit into the picture.
Okay, I didn't know Tanya a whole lot, but she dated my cousin for like 7 years or so, you know, and they had a pretty crazy relationship, I guess you would say, but I've met her a few times at the ballpark because we'd play on a family softball team together, and that's pretty much... the only time we really associated, except for when he ever needed anything.
So she was Mr. Beebe's friend, basically, girlfriend?
Yeah, that was his girlfriend, yes.
And one other question. I assume that you, at least up to that point, you and Mr. Beebe got along fairly well. And how did he get along with Amy? Were they on good terms and friends? Or?
Well, I know they used to be, but now that I look back on it, I can see that she never really wanted to be around him. Because I don't know.
Who never wanted to be around him? You mean Tanya never did, or you mean Amy Sue?
Amy never did. Because for a little bit there, he was doing ultimate fighting, and a few of my other cousins were doing it, and I was trying to help out with the wrestling, and she didn't want me to have no part of it.
And then from there, when does the police realize that they need to step in? When do they actually come to the house and take down the information besides 911 over the phone?
Well, I believe what happened is they called me back later on that day to see if I've heard from her yet, and I tell them no, and they ended up sending a police officer out later on that night at like 10 or 11 o'clock. I don't remember the exact time. And then he took down the story and everything.
And how does he talk to you nicely? Is he treating you pretty good?
Yeah, he was nice about it, and pretty much, I think he might have been the one that told me that it's usually 24 to 48 hours, and that if she's not back, to let them know or something. And then I remember waking up at 7, I remember calling back at 7:30 in the morning, telling them, you know what, it's been 24 hours, what do we need to do to find my wife?
Now, I'm just trying to think of what shape you were in emotionally by 11 o'clock that night. I mean, you know, you've been hoping most of the day that she had just was doing something, went shopping with a friend or whatever, and would be home at any time. By 11 o'clock at night, what's your mental state then? Are you suspecting that really something is very, very wrong?
Yeah, you know, you have that in the back of your head, but you don't believe that she's hurt or anything like that, you know? Because the way the police made it sound is, you know, 90% of these cases, the people take off for drugs and stuff and are end up found a few days later. But what they didn't understand is that no matter what, she would have been here for her kids.
And there was,
after
of course,
school.
From...
Yeah.
Right.
And from the police perspective and yours, as far as that goes, at that point, I mean, you hadn't yet to see anything to indicate, like, there was no damage in the house, like there had been a struggle or anything. So there really was nothing obvious to indicate.
No,
there
not
had
at all.
Problem.
Just that her purse was still here.
And
that's odd.
And that's really odd.
Jamie, when did your organization get involved in this, and when did you get involved?
Danny, I think it was it Tuesday night, James, or Wednesday, I believe, maybe?
Well, you guys were supposed to, at first it was going to be Wednesday, but then the police said they had a 99.9% lead that they she was spotted in Battle Creek, so they told us to call you guys off, because I think the dog team was like 30 minutes away, and so they told us to send them back home, because they hit, because it's one of their sources that witnessed this or something.
I know
and
frustrating. It was frustrating for... I have to explain one thing also, is that there's actually two different groups. You have the Missing You Foundation, which I am involved with, and we have the Mid-Michigan Working Dog Search and Recovery Team, and it's like two different teams that work together that day. And Sheila, she is the... Sheila Eldridge, she is one of the main people on the dog team, and I think they were having conversations.
Can you speak up, because you're kind of not coming in too well.
Okay, Sheila Eldridge, she is with the dog team, and I think her team and James's family were talking, and we were Missing You Foundation was also talking with the family, and then our group was calling the dog team, and we were just trying to get a time that we could come up to Hartford and do the search, and we kept getting told we have to wait, we have to wait. We actually literally had our boots and gloves on, ready to go. And I think it might have been Wednesday night, late Wednesday night, I received a call, and it says, you guys come up anyway. We want you up here. And so we all got together on the telephone and decided that we will be up Thursday morning. I arrived about 9 o'clock. I think the dog team, they're a little farther north of me, so they didn't actually get there till about 11:30, I think, maybe.
Go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to ask, how many people, how big is the team, or the team at least that showed up for this particular search?
Well, the team can get quite large. For this actual search, there was, let's see, one... I'm going to say there was probably about six or seven people on the team.
And when do you learn about Tanya being missing, and now there's some connection here?
You know, we did not learn about Tanya until after the actual crime scene was found. And I don't remember who it was. James's father, I think, was with us, and he had mentioned something about, you know, we haven't seen Tanya since Monday either, and so we really basically didn't know about Tanya at all. So,
and James, during this period now, a couple of days have gone by, you know, and the police thought they had this 99.9% sighting in Battle Creek. What did you hear during that time frame, from the time Amy went missing until the searchers got involved? What did you hear from Mr. Beebe? Was he in regular contact with you?
No, not at all. I hadn't talked to him at all. I know, because come Wednesday, then everybody started wondering where he's been, how he come he hasn't been helping, and then we realized that he actually posted it on his Facebook to, like, if anyone has seen Amy Hensley, to call him, and because she was missing. And then another day we organized our own search on Tuesday and had a bunch of people going down the trails and stuff around my house. And he actually called one of my cousins to find out where they were searching.
And during this time, too, your mother-in-law goes on television and says, if anybody has seen, you know, she's pleading for her daughter, but she does something and says, use the code word if you can get to me, doesn't she?
Yes.
Meaning that the code word was something that she had taught both her children when they were younger, that if they're in trouble, they get the code word out, that to please call. Not a code word for, I'm a battered woman, but a code word for, I'm in danger, the predator's gotten me. Right, James?
Yes, right.
And so, Denny, what was interesting about this, and Jamie Jones and I had spoken about this as well, was that because of events, because Amy was by herself, because James had taken the car that day, she was home alone, how was things locked up, people started to have and talk about things that were, to me, a football. It wasn't. Amy Hensley was not a battered woman. Amy Hensley was a victim of a horrific crime, but nobody would know that yet. And the circumstances of the events, everybody was jumping to conclusions, even the national media, and trying to literally pin wherever or whatever happened to Amy Hensley on James. And it was a lynching, as far as I was concerned. And it was something that I had not seen people do. And then we were receiving phone calls to say, because all we do is intimate partner homicide and violence, as far as, or all I do is that, people were calling me, very well-known people, and saying, why didn't you write about this story? What is it about it? Why aren't you even on this? And I said, because I don't have enough information. And then I started calling around and checking and figuring out what had happened. And before she is found, I'm on the phone with Jamie Jones. And he and I speak. And I find out what the timeline is, what happened. But because it's an ongoing investigation, as we do in all of these cases, I don't talk about it to anyone because I can't. And because to me, after speaking to James, after speaking to other relatives, after speaking to friends, after speaking to law enforcement, you knew what was going on. But the public's perception was automatic armchair quarterback, we're going to lynch him. And I don't think I've ever seen such a gathering of fools in my life.
Oh, I found myself defending him every day, and it just got so outrageous with some of the comments and things that were out there. It was just ridiculous. Really, really was.
And that's why you and I spoke, Jamie, because you said, you said to me, you called right away as you were doing these searches, and you said, did I know about the case? And I said, kind of. And you said, what's your take on it? And I said, I don't have one because you're going to tell me now. And that's exactly what happened.
Sure.
And we started to talk, and I asked you specific questions, and then you said to me, here, talk to me. And it was me asking certain questions, finding out, before rushing to judgment. I know it looks like sometimes that we do that. We don't. I in particular do not do that because it doesn't serve a purpose. And then why don't you, is James with you when, at any point when you are doing the searches, or are you in communication with him from where you're going to search at?
I was there a few hours before the dog team arrived, so I was pretty much, I was talking with James and the family, kind of comforting him and just going over kind of what we do and what we can offer and giving them a little bit of hope, everything that I could possibly do. They were very, very distraught, and just everything in my power to do whatever we had to do to find Amy. And so James and I spoke a lot that day, and you work this out in your head before you even get there, and you're going over it and over it, and I got to see how this husband is acting, and will he send off red flags and this and that. And I, just talked to James on the phone, so I didn't know his demeanor and things like that. And I'm a pretty good judge of character, and, you can fool me, but, I get really good gut feelings. And I met James, and I met James's family, and I knew right away just there's no way, and, there's just no way in hell he's involved with anything, period. And, I just knew that, just meeting him, shaking his hand for the first minute, I knew. And so basically we were there probably a couple hours talking with James. I was there a couple hours talking to James before the dog team and things got there. So James did not go out. They stayed at the house.
And then once you are, where do you get the feeling to go to over to the BB's property? How do you know to do that?
Well, I received a phone call from a Facebook friend, and I was probably halfway up there, and she had some police friends that were up in the area. She's from the area. And she kind of gave me a heads up on the way. She says, remember this name, Junior Beebe, when you get there. She said, I got it from law enforcement, and they said, just remember that name when you get there. So I said, okay, I will. And I still have all my notes from that day, and I wrote that down. And I got up there, and I think initially the dog team actually sent some dogs out around the perimeter, and there had been a lot of snow moved around, so her scent actually was kind of up and down the road pretty much,
How much snow was there? Was there enough to see a path to turn you away at different times when you're up
there? There was quite a, I don't know, there was probably about 6 inches of snow on the ground. And it started snowing really bad later that day, but while we were there and before, from the Monday to the Thursday, it had snowed several times, I think, and I think they had to plow the driveway out a few times. So that did send the scent around, contaminate the area a little bit. I felt strongly that she was not in that area. That was not even an area of interest. So I was inside talking with James's father, I believe, and just asking him, just asking everyone, what else do you have? I remember sitting there at the table and asking a million questions. I said, I'm sorry I'm asking a million questions, but in here, in these questions somewhere, we're going to find something. And he spoke up and he said, there used to be this little trailer, this little cab, this little trailer that used to sit down by the road over on this one road, and it's not there anymore, and you can still see where the snow used to sit. So right away, that sparked my curiosity. I said, whose property? Then the Junior BB came up. Right away, boom, I'm interested. So I think it's been a while and so many cases in between, but I believe we went out. Sheila and I, we got the team together, and Sheila and I don't know how many of the dog team, and James's father, and I think maybe Amy's brother and another gentleman went out to this property to show them where it was at, and it wasn't long after that I got a phone call and said that I needed to come out to the property. They had found something, so someone takes me out to this property, and we get out there, and sure enough, we find that they had found blood and things like that. So they could not get law enforcement to come. I think it was an hour before they even showed up after they had called and told them about this. So we waited and
waited.
While
they were searching by my house.
Yeah, they were still out there riding up and down the road in their cars, and so it took quite a long time to get them there. And I don't think that they had ever been involved in something like that before, because they didn't know what to do. They didn't have any rubber gloves and plastic bags to even gather information and things like that. And the dog team had everything that they needed and supplied that kind of stuff. And they were just going to pick things up with their hands. And we told them that's not the way to do things. And so it was kind of a weird kind of thing. They really did not know what to do. So, I guess they did a field test while we were there, and they decided that to ship us out of the area. So, that's when we knew that it was over. So, I returned back to the house then.
Go ahead, Dave.
Just wondering, did Tanya have any family involved? I mean, were there does she have any relatives there that were also searching and that type of thing, or no?
No, nobody even knew that Tanya was missing at the time.
Oh, so, okay. And now, all through this, Mr. Beebe still hasn't participated as far as searching or going out looking anywhere or acting like he was looking for her, other than a Facebook notification.
No, actually, that Wednesday, my dad actually took some flyers to his house, and he sat there eating a bowl of cereal, asking him if we found anything yet or heard from her.
Very odd, I think. And then, where are you when you get, who comes in and gives you the news? Is it law enforcement? Is it Jamie? How do you learn?
Well, that day, it wasn't Amy's brother that was out there. It was two of my buddies that went out with the dog team. And they're pretty big guys, and they come back here, And my one good friend, he's real close to me. He was real shaken up and kind of teared up and frustrated and stuff. So I kind of knew he seen something, but he wouldn't tell me what he seen.
I think
and, you know,
Kayla and I came back to the house before they showed up, didn't we?
You know, I honestly don't remember. I
yeah,
know there's a house full of people.
It was a really hard time right then, I remember. And I knew we were coming back. We were going to go back home. And we came and I talked to Brenda and Bob and I think Wendy and her husband and you. I think we took you into the kitchen or something and said a few things. And then we left. So there was that moment in there, I think. And then right after that, you probably don't remember a lot about what happened after that because there was just a lot of things coming down.
No, but I do remember.
You remember what?
I was just going to say, I remember the law enforcement coming in that evening. Well, because, see, first, everybody started talking about seeing on Facebook that there's two bodies found and everything. And, you know, and I didn't think anything of it because no one would really give out details. I just heard that. And then not too long later, law enforcement came and they had the victim's right units. And then I kind of just knew right then. Something
wasn't right.
But they explained
things to you, didn't they? They talked to you, and did they talk to the boys, or did you?
No, at this point, we didn't have the kids here. So they were here for the first night, and then they left. They went to a friend's for a while.
Benny, being former law enforcement, how important is it not to have the children around when you've got this kind of a situation going on?
I think it's very important. They're can come a point, you know, later on in the process where you need to interview the children depending on the situation. But when you're in the search mode and things like this are happening, I think it's better if they're not physically on the location. And am I correct, Jamie, did I hear you correctly, that when the police were notified that there's something had been found and you had a possible crime scene, it took them about an hour or so to get there, and then they didn't have the anything with them for collecting evidence and so forth. And you guys, your team and the dog team, more or less, had to supply the materials they needed.
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, I don't know. I think just from remembering back on that day, and even being there on the scene that time, it just kind of seemed like their professionalism was just unreal. I mean, it's like the guys sitting around watching a football game kind of thing, and you know, that kind of threw me off a little bit. You know, things like that are important to us. You know, we were very professional on the scene and things like that, and it was just like a, you know, walk in the park to them, and just you know.
Let's go a little bit further. If it hadn't been for you, and I'm not, and only because I know a lot about this, and because you are trained, and everybody that is with the Missing You Foundation and any other organization who is worth their salt are trained and certified to be out there. So it was you. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone further. They had called that scene Deer Blood. It was not. It was you. And had you not been persistent and then provided what they needed before they went in there, because you said, don't do that. You got to get gloves on.
Sure.
Because I spoke to you right after, and you were persistent in what they had to do. That's what preserved that crime scene. Your training, Jamie, and I think in so many of these cases that we don't have recoveries or people miss certain things, that you most of all. I rarely see someone who, I mean, you have developed a strong relationship with the Henley family. You have gone above and beyond. You were the one that brought her home. You were the one that found her. And in you are to be commended, and that's not even enough for what you did, for what Missing You Foundation does. And that's what people need to understand is the professionalism and what you do, how you steer, in many cases, law enforcement to do certain things on a crime scene that perhaps they don't have the training for. It's cold, it's snowing, there's other elements going on. They would have missed it if it weren't for you. So for you, I think, and I know that James knows that, don't you, James?
Yes.
And so,
I'm,
sir,
I'm, uh,
if, Go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to say, Susan, I really am impressed with this because, as we know, that a botched crime scene, if it isn't handled properly, can really sabotage any chance for an arrest or at least for a prosecution and conviction. I mean, you know, if that one shot at the crime scene, if it's screwed up and evidence is destroyed or improperly collected, that can that can really put the whole effort at getting justice for the victim in jeopardy.
Sure,
but
so
I think it also goes towards the yeah. But quickly, within a matter of days, they recover them, and which doesn't happen so quickly. It goes towards his training. Everybody that is on these, that goes on these, are trained. The dogs are trained. The handlers are trained. They're SAR searchers. They have to go and be certified to do this themselves or with the animals. This is not, okay, I'm going to go volunteer. And it's dark out there. It's snowing. Again, with all the elements, you've got Jamie Jones out there, who somebody should give him a medal like the governor for doing this, because it would have been months. The ground would have been covered up based on the snow that fell 2 days later. Forget it.
Right.
And again, it was because of you, Jamie. So that is a big part of this. And you don't stop there. Your connection with the family continues, and it has continued. And the relationship that you have with James and the boys, they look up to you. And that's important to this. So when you know James and she's finally found, you know, there's a lot for you to do. And thank goodness you have people around you there. Was your mother-in-law there with you?
Yeah. Yep. And my father-in-law.
And your father-in-law. And you had a good relationship with them. And then you had to, you know, start preparing for things. And you know, that night you do an interview that the world sees. And again, Denny, this goes to judgment, that I would have taken drugs that night just to get through it. Because when you're victimized, when you're traumatized by a crime like this, of this magnitude, of any magnitude, you can't walk, you can't see, you can't put one foot in front of the other. And I hope that you do or are given a sedative of some sort, because, you know, your mind is going other places. You can't think correctly. And you still do this interview. Based on that interview, people continue to say, oh, you must have had something to do with this. When do they arrest Junior Beebe?
That night.
Yeah, the night that they...
Okay.
You
know, and then
he
people
actually showed
continue
up at the crime scene.
Okay, he showed up at the crime scene. Why?
Cordy claimed that he had to pick up a generator.
For our listeners that don't know this, what happens is during these days that they are looking for both Amy and Tanya, what happens is he's texting his mother the whole time about towels and sheets, and he needs more of this and more of that. She covers up for him, and doesn't probably know exactly what's going on, but I think she puts two and two together. And is she the one that tells you some half-baked story about Amy?
No, I didn't talk to her at all.
Okay. Somebody says a story about Amy and a relationship, or they conjure up these things. And,
well, actually, that's what Junior told law enforcement after they arrested him.
Okay. And Jamie Jones, how difficult is this when you've got this kind of malarkey going on? When there's such a serious event, and to disarm and do things, it just you need to give the family closure, not open your mouth and give lip service to something you don't know. How important is that for the families after the remains have been found?
Well, you know, it'll never stop. It you know, with every case you have that, and you know, I always know it's coming. So it's. You know, with a family like that, that Junior Beebe's been in trouble all of his life. His mom's been covering for him for all of his life. So that's kind of, and I'm sure James could tell you stories, horror stories about that. I mean, this is certainly wasn't
for sure.
Beebe's first time. And, you know, his mother had, and she was covering up for him after the sentencing even her statement on the sentencing, you know, she wasn't done covering for him then, you know, so it's important for me and for us as a group to continue our relationship with the families. You know, I've gotten close with I call them my Hartford family, and We're gonna do some things here coming up soon, as soon as the restaurant opens, and we're gonna kind of have a heart for day and have everybody down for a pizza and subs and things. And so I like to follow up, and I gained family. You know, I gained a lot of family, a lot of great family. These people are some of the best people you'll ever meet in your life. Just
well,
so
are you. You know what? You are too.
Sure.
I mean, the heart that you have, and to reach out even afterwards and to say, can you help them? Can you help me help them? You know, I'm going to be in contact with them. And I don't know if you remember, James, when you and I were continuing to talk and you said, you know, how much Jamie Jones meant to you and you know, what a great guy he is.
Yep.
And you know, that really helped you through a lot, didn't it?
Yes, it sure did. And he still invites me on cases to this day.
And you learn, and you know, it's only been, Denny, it's only been since January 28th, and this is, we're in September. They just had the trial. The trial took place on August 3rd in Van Buren District County. And you don't see, Denny, families that have, you know, moved on as nicely, as smoothly, because it's been a big transition, as the Hensley family do.
Oh, absolutely. It's and you know, when I was just talking about arresting Mr. Beebe that same night, when that arrest was made, James, what was your reaction? I mean, were you thinking, oh my God, they can't be, he would never do anything like that? Or did you say, hey, I think they got the right guy? Or what were your thoughts when your cousin was arrested?
Well, see, that, well, actually, Wednesday night, they took me in for interrogation, and that's when they told me that the their 99.9% lead fell through. And then I remember people asking, you know, where's Junior been? And that's when I asked law enforcement, I said, well, how come nobody has been talking to my cousin? Because he was the last person at my house. And then they said that they had 30 people doing, chasing 30 tips the following day, and he was on that list. And they still never had him until later on that point.
You know,
so
what
you were suspicious of him. You were not. You did not think they had the wrong guy necessarily when they made the arrest then.
No, not at that point. I did not. Then everything just kind of fell into place, and you realize things, I guess.
And did you have to testify at the trial?
Yes, I did.
And how were
how long were you on the stand for?
I don't know, maybe 10 minutes. I don't remember. It wasn't a real long time.
How did you, he's in the courtroom, and how was it to even be in the same room with him? Because this is the first time you've seen him in person since before this happened, right?
Right. It's just, you just get so mad, and, it's just horrible to be in the same room as him because you're just so mad and have to face him, and I just stare at him all the time.
Were you able
He'd
to prepare a victim statement at Impact before the judge sentenced him last week?
Yes, I did.
And did somebody help you with that?
No, I did it myself.
And were you able to read it in court?
Yep, and I made sure I showed him the pictures of my kids and Amy so that way he knows what he took away from them and me.
Did the boys help you a little bit with your remarks or no?
No.
Okay.
Jamie,
go ahead.
Jamie, did you have to testify too with this, you know, about the finding, the discovery and so forth?
The team leader for the dog team, Sheila, did. Sheila did a testifying on, I don't think she was on very long, maybe 10 minutes. It was a very quick,
It was a quick trial.
Trial.
They broadcasted it on television.
Yeah, the evidence was just overwhelming. You know, he with his testimony, I think his testimony alone sealed his fate. He just, you know, there's just no way it happened like he said it did. There's just, there's no way possible. So, and the jury.
What did he claim happened when he gave his version of the story? How ridiculous was it?
I believe what his testimony was, that him and Amy were having some type of affair, and Tanya had came up to the little cabin, the little camper, and saw them kissing or something to that effect, and Tanya grabs the gun and shoots Amy, and he grabs the gun and wrestles it from Tanya and shoots her. If you could see this little camper, there's no way possible. I mean, you could reach your hand out from the other side of the trailer, and as big as this guy is, and a little girl like Tanya, he wouldn't have to wrestle too hard. And with the forensic evidence that was found, with only having Tanya's blood in the camper, and it was only a little bit on the door, they knew that there was no way it happened like that whatsoever. So his testimony was over before it started.
Yes, it was.
James, did you have a hard time? You sat in the trial every day, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And was it difficult for you?
Yes, at moments for sure. Because, you know, every time the jury would walk out, he'd stand up and face our way. And I'd just stare at him the whole time. And he'd never make eye contact.
Last week, the judge sentenced him to, why don't you say?
Two life sentences.
There's no possibility of parole, and he spends
with
all
no
of his breathing days. Okay.
Yeah, he got one first degree, one second degree, and I believe he got two felony firearm charges that carried a couple years or something as well, with 293 days served or something.
It's a
like
good
that
time.
Yeah.
How are the boys doing, James?
Oh, the boys are doing great. They stay involved with football and sports, and they got tons of good friends. So, but they're the ones that keep me strong.
Because the holidays are coming, so it's going to be kind of tough. And, you know, you have a chance right here because this goes into podcast forever. And what do you want them to know most of all for the world to hear about Amy Sue Hensley, your wife and their mom?
Oh, that her kids were everything to her. You know, she'd never miss a sporting event, or she's always up at the school, always helping out in class, you know, and she'd have eight kids at her house on the weekends, and if I was working, she'd be taking the kids to the beach, them and their friends, just the greatest mother. Her kids were her world.
And she loved them with all her heart.
Definitely.
How old are the boys?
Jared is 11 and Jonah is 8.
Okay, so they're pretty young, and they're going to have a lot of questions and things, and I'm sure they're starting school now. This is a new year for them, and the trial's over with, and this is a small town, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And how has the community been with you since all of this, through all this? This is pretty quick. This doesn't usually happen so quick from the sort of finding, you know, there's time, there's delays, there's defense delays, there's, you know, discovery that needs to be made. This happened between January of this year to August of this year, everything happened pretty quick order. How has the community been reacting to you? You know, you're by yourself pretty much now, and the boys are going to need assistance for a very long time as far as support. How are they handling, you know, all of you and you know, embracing you, the community, the church?
Oh, the community has been great. You know, we have all our friends here and everything, and everyone's just been so supportive, and, you know, I don't know what I'd do without everybody.
I don't think there's any replacement for the kind of support that you have had through this whole thing, you know, from Jamie and your neighbors and friends and relatives and in-laws. It's, you know, I mean, to make it through something like you've been through, without that support, it certainly would have been much tougher and maybe impossible. So thank God you had the friends and relatives and acquaintances and so forth you've had that they really came up for you big through something
sure,
like
and
this.
And still do.
And you did a beautiful eulogy for her at the funeral. You know, you have kept her out there. I know you and Jamie Jones are doing some things to keep that out. I know that we are going to be doing some things as well because it's very important. I know that you want to work and help other families. Jamie Jones, you have a chance right here, right now, sir. The world is listening, and you have an opportunity to tell people how important it is when somebody goes missing and what they need to do.
Well, the first thing is, you know, I try to tell everyone. I know they have the 24-hour thing, but just get with the missing person group and get them involved as quickly as possible, because there's things that they can actually do before you get law enforcement involved, before they want to get involved. Get the media involved. Get pictures out there. And there's things that media will do, and there's things that you can do. You know, we're definitely here for everyone. We don't pick and choose our cases. We take everyone. So get with the Missing You Foundation if you have a problem. We'll lead you in the right direction and get you started in. And we'll be there for you from beginning till end and after. So it is very important in the first few hours, if you think your loved one's missing and you know there's something wrong, get with the missing person group. It doesn't matter who they are. Just get with somebody that and be very careful to get with somebody that's credible. You don't want to just get with somebody that that you just, you know, you don't do a little homework on them. And because there's a lot of people out there that will take advantage of missing persons.
That's right. You psychics. I always say about psychics, Denny, that if they predict, then they would call in their rewards themselves and collect it if they knew actually what happened to somebody.
Yeah, Jamie certainly makes a good point. You got to be careful, because people that are going through this type of trauma in their life are usually vulnerable. And somebody comes up and, you know, tells them what they want to hear, you know, about how much they can help them in this matter.
But they charge them. They charge them for it, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure they do.
And that's got to stop. And for people that want to help this amazing organization, and, you know, they take calls 24/7. They're out there. The website is www.missingyoufoundation.org. And for people that are listening, the importance of what groups like this do, it doesn't stop and begin with sending out dogs or people or answering the phone. As you heard throughout this whole show, it continues, even to the point where this searcher went above and beyond and reached out to other people when people were doing things to this family and hurting this family. And as a homicide survivor, it is the worst thing that you can do to a family, to point fingers, to make accusations when you don't know. And we live in a quick world with the internet and quick information. That shouldn't be a rush to judgment. And again, you know, in this case, and I think that's really how Jamie Jones and I had gotten hooked up, was because when he and I began to speak and I said, you know, I don't do that and I don't shoot from the hip. It might look like I do, and I know that Denny and I laugh about that all the time, but I don't. Because we don't ever come out with anything until we have all the information. And Denny, that's what CrimeWire is about, isn't it?
Exactly, Susan, just exactly. It's getting the story out there, but doing it the right way.
And to get it out there in a way that, and so what we wanted to do tonight, which was important, was dedicate this hour to Sue Hensley and Mom and somebody that is never going to be forgotten in the hearts of that community and those boys, and Tanya Horwath as well. We didn't hear much about her, and we would extend the same courtesy if a family member wanted to come, and we would be able to do a segment about her. But this is about the perseverance of the Missing You Foundation with a family, and it's also about a father who has been through the ringer himself, not just with the death, but with the public pretty much pointing fingers at things until the truth finally came out. Again, the foundation is www.missingyoufoundation.org. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, public relations team at imaginepublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, September 27th, 2011. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. And for those of you who are organized crime buffs, if you want to tune in tomorrow night at the same time, I'm going to be doing a show called Mob Talk. And our guest for the debut show is going to be FBI undercover agent Jack Garcia, author of the New York Times bestseller, Making Jack Falcone. God bless and good night.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
See you, James.
You take care, Jamie. Thank you, Susan.